Hello, this is Jim from Stuff We've Seen, and I just wanted to remind you before the episode begins that you can find us on the web at stuffweveseen.com, or you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify Podcasts, or tune in. And if you do that, you'll get every episode without having to remind yourself. And you can catch us on Instagram or Twitter. And you always, always feel free to send us a comment at feedback@jimandteal.com. Now, get ready for the podcast that brings the experience factor back into movie going. And it's coming up.
Influence of television. Yeah, now, Marshall McLuhan deals with it in terms of it being a high intensity, you understand, a hot medium.
What I wouldn't give for a large sock with horse manure in it.
Which uses essentially
what do you do when you get stuck on a movie line with a guy like this behind you?
Wait a minute, why can't I give my opinion? This is a free country?
He can give you. Do you have to give it so loud? I mean, aren't you ashamed to pontificate like that? And the funny part of it is, Marshall McLuhan, you don't know anything about Marshall McLuhan's work.
Really, really. I happen to teach a class at Columbia called TV, Media, and Culture. So I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan, well, have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny, because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here. So yeah, just let me come over here a second.
Oh, I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Oh, boy, if life were only like this.
Back to Stuff We've Seen, this is Jim. And now, here he is, soon to be the lead pallbearer for the David Koch funeral, Teal. How's it going, buddy?
Well, pretty good. It's sad work, but somebody's got to do it, and heavy lifting is my forte.
Yes. You've been bulking up in anticipation, but you thought it was going to be the older brother, Charles.
I did. You
know, so maybe you'll get to do some more work soon.
hey, I won't turn down the hours.
Right. So we're back, and we've been away for a couple of weeks. I haven't been anywhere. I've been here lots of stuff. You've been away. Yes.
I've been away in a land without movies.
You have, yes. So, you know, I trust you've seen pretty much nothing.
a few odd things, odds and ends here and there, but yeah, pretty much nothing. A warning. I have a warning for you.
Oh, okay.
We'll get to it. We'll get to it.
I anticipate the warning. Okay. Yeah. Well, I didn't really get out to the theaters much because we're kind of at the point where there's not a lot.
Right.
Being offered. We're kind of in those really dog days of summer movies.
Yeah. Although there's, there's one or two good ones out there. I'm thinking of one in particular, which I think is.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll talk later, because I'll tell you, I got a story, and I mentioned this on our last program, that I was going to be able to get to New York City and see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a second time, but this time I would get to see it in 70 millimeter.
Right.
And I was curious to see it because I wanted to know, does that change my view on the movie, seeing it a second time? And, you know, because as when we discussed with the Millennial, I was probably, out of the three of us, the least enthusiastic, even though I really liked a lot of it.
Yeah. I think that's true. Yeah.
Now, the story is a little preface, and I will use the words of Ringo Starr. I tell this story with peace and love. Peace and love. I got to see the movie. I met up with Bill from Queens.
Oh, our old friend Bill from Queens. He needs to stop by the show again.
Yes, we got to get him on there. He's got a pretty busy and hectic life, I'm going to tell you.
Yeah,
that'll play into the story in a little bit. Well, he's got a lot of children at various ages at home. He's got like five kids or something. That's a lot. So he's pretty busy. And I was fortunate enough that he was able to make some time to come into the city and see me. I hadn't seen him in many years, and how I saw him the last time was at a 70mm screening with my son. We happened to be near where he lives, and he just happened to be there with two of his kids at the same time. Before that, I hadn't seen him in 20 years.
What film was that?
That was a 70mm screening of West Side Story.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And that was itself was pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad it's such a weak film. I'm glad it's getting remade by a real filmmaker like Spielberg.
Yeah. You know, maybe a quick segue here. That one's a real puzzler to me because the film West Side Story is definitely at a time and a place.
Yeah.
And it was contemporary for its time when it was first a Broadway musical in the late 50s or mid 50s. And then when the film was made in 1961 by Robert Wise and Jerome Robbins, it felt still contemporary for the period.
Yeah.
And now when you watch it, it's dated for sure, but it's dated in the way that it reminds you of, oh, this is the kind of film that would have come out in 1961. But
it's still like the last time I said it's beautiful to look at.
Well, it's gorgeous. Yes. It won the Oscar for best cinematography that year, and it was shot in 70mm.
Yeah, and it's beautiful, and the filmmaking is great. It's a film that I think ages very well, is what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, it's not that it like ages bad in that, oh, this is just too outdated and goofy. It's a perfect film that I never thought that it needed to be remade. And if you were going to remake it, I could understand if somebody was going to take a challenge and maybe, bring it into the present day and it would be completely reworking. You'd have to rework the songs. A lot of things wouldn't make sense now. But for some reason, and I really don't understand the reason, and maybe it won't be until it comes out and I see it, Spielberg wants to remake this film, but they aren't setting it in the present day.
Right.
They're keeping the time period.
Yes.
In the 60s. So I'm not sure what the point is. I really don't. I don't know why he felt possessed to remake it.
It makes no sense. It reminds me of Gus Van Sant's Psycho.
Right. The shot by shot. But color. Hey.
Hey, it's in color. And here we go. This one will be in color. Wait. It makes no sense.
Well, the difference will be that this time, any shots indoors where you see windows, there'll be lots of like grainy light shooting through in the Janusz Kaminski style. That is probably the difference.
Oh, man.
And, the thing is, the choreography was amazing.
Yes.
Like, it's just there are things that I don't know could be improved upon.
Yeah. Not like Cats.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that preview. I bet you've seen that trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty out there, man. As a matter of fact, this is funny, right? I watched the trailer the second it came out. It was just came up on my phone.
Right.
So I was like, I got to watch this. And I looked at it. This is before I heard any, chatter on the internet about it. And I watched this thing and I'm like, oh my God, this thing is a visual freak fest and I've got to watch it on the big screen because it's a weird nightmare. It's bizarre. I mean, there is like cat humans or something. And then there were these big sets and I'm like, this is crazy. And then I find out that everybody is freaking out over this. It's like they find it scary and creepy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes, it looks scary and creepy. I can't wait. So, yes, I am going to see Cats. I may be going alone, but I'm going to see it just because.
I'm definitely not going alone because I watched this because of all the chatter. I understood what people were talking about. I didn't have that kind of intense reaction to it, but I decided to show it to my family without giving them any of the hype ahead of time.
Right.
And just so they just watched it blind and and as soon as it was done, they said, that looks awesome. We can't wait to see it.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
So, I won't be
going
alone.
For Fritz the Cat, the musical. if they do it in the same way, it'll really be out there. Okay, so we'll go back to the story.
Yeah.
So I get to New York City, and I'm going to go see it in the afternoon. And it's a really hot day. It's about 90 degrees that day. And the movie didn't start till 3:30. For some reason, I thought it started at 3. So I arrived at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I ran into Bill at the Strand bookstore. He texted me that he was at the Strand and what time was I, you know, in town.
Yeah.
And I happened to be almost like directly across from the Strand okay. at the time. And I said, oh, I'll be there in a couple minutes. And then I just, you know, surprised him. So then we had to walk around for a good while before we could go into the movie. And then finally we decided we'd just go in early, right? Because it's cooler. It was so hot. And it's at the Village East Cinema. That is on the corner of 2nd Avenue and 12th Street.
Yes.
And I hadn't been there since I was in college. And, of course, this movie theater, which was an old Jewish theater back in vaudeville days.
Right.
It is directly diagonal from where you and I shared an apartment my junior year of college.
Yes. Back in the old days.
And if you recall, February 14th of 1991,
yeah.
it was, the theater reopened as a movie theater.
Yes.
And we were directly across. I don't know if we went opening night.
I don't know if we did. It was pretty crowded, I think.
Yeah. But what was great is anytime we wanted to see a movie, we went over earlier the day, got the tickets, and then we would look out our window. And if we looked like we saw a crowd, then we would know yes. it was time to go over and get our seats. So this film was playing in their big house. And I had forgotten that it was like a really big old kind of a stadium seating,
yes.
even before stadium seating. It was a pretty cool looking venue. And unfortunately, it was another one of those places where you have to pre-pick your seat.
Right.
And I kind of forgot about it. I was like, oh, come on. I hate that. I just want to be able to pick the seat I want. And because you know what? You pick something on a screen and then you walk in and it may not be where you wanted to
exactly.
sit. And that sort of happened. I had my contacts on and I couldn't see the screen that they were picking very well. So I picked sort of in the back, but having not been into that theater in a while,
right.
we were sitting pretty far up. And it turned out to be fine, but I wished that we were sitting a few rows, you know, closer.
Yeah.
So, you know, we get ready to watch this thing. And one difference between where I first saw the movie at Somerville Davis Square Theater, that's a theater that they really care about
right.
movies. I mean, they love movies, the eat, sleep, and breathe movies, the projectionist. It's just like it's his pleasure to show something that's on celluloid. And a lot of times when they're doing something special, he'll come out before the movie and he'll tell you all about it and give you some technical details. And it's really great. Then you get to this City Cinemas and every person who's working there, it's just a job.
Right. Well, yeah.
And they only look half happy to be there. You know, or no, I wouldn't even say the word happy. Yeah, and these people are just, they got a job and they're in the city and they're doing it. And there's just no love going on, which is kind of sad, you know, that they're showing it in 70 millimeters. So somebody in the organization
right.
cares, but the employees don't. And I was actually worried because sometimes if you get people who don't care, projecting something like 70 millimeter can be really tough.
Right.
Spoiler alert, there was no such problems that day. We didn't have one technical issue, which was great. So the first thing that happened is during the 35 millimeter screenings,
yeah.
they didn't have any previews to show
right,
because
right, right.
there was no previews being given on the 35 millimeter presentation. However, for the 70 millimeter presentation, they did have a trailer, which was really cool to see a 70
yeah.
millimeter trailer, is the upcoming Warner Brothers release, The Joker.
Never heard of it.
Okay, yeah. Well, there's a guy named Joaquin Phoenix. He's going to be the Joker, you know, because we haven't heard his origin story yet. Forget about the 1989 Batman for a second. You know, it's going to get a 70 millimeter release, believe it or
right.
not.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, there's a theater in Boston, the Coolidge Corner in Brookline. They are going to show it on October 4th, I think it's when it comes out. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get there or not, but, you know, if I'm going to see The Joker, I'd like to see it in 70 millimeter, if I could. And it's actually a 185 film, which is interesting that the 70 millimeter blow up in order to show it 1.85. If you keep that ratio, you're going to have black bars on the left and right of the negative.
Okay.
So it really won't even use the full negative, but you get the brightness and the sharpness. And I've seen the trailer in theaters before on digital presentations. It looked okay, but man, it just had a different vibe when you saw that 70 millimeter trailer.
Interesting.
Yeah, the sharpness. And there's just, it's a very weird thing. I can't ever quite describe the difference to people when you're watching something in 70 millimeter, because the negative is so big. You don't get quite the same amount of flicker that you might get in a 35 millimeter presentation. And so before digital came along, 70 millimeter, it was a big difference.
Yes, it was a huge difference. Yeah.
So it's kind of like getting maybe like, I think the equivalent of 70 millimeter is seeing like an 8K presentation.
Right.
So one of the few ways that you can see an 8K presentation is if you go to AMC's Dolby Digital Cinema. They have dual 4K projectors that are aligned, and that gives you kind of an 8K experience.
Yeah, very pixel doubling.
Yeah, so that looks pretty close to what maybe 70 millimeter looks like. But you're getting it on film. So the details of film, the grain of film, you see it. And so that's pretty cool. And then the movie starts. And I can't tell you, I really feel like it has something to do with the 70 millimeter and the fact that I knew everything that was going to come.
Right. You know what you're getting into in a different way on a second view.
Yeah. So I can watch it a little differently. But from the second it started, I was into this movie and sucked in. The 70 millimeter presentation, the brightness and the sharpness, the kind of details that are filling every inch of that frame of that movie.
Yes. The art direction is
like when the cups that are in, Rick Dalton's collecting his little Hopalong Cassidy cups that actually are their Tarantino's.
Right.
The sharpness and detail on those cups is unreal. And also the aging of the face, the wrinkles, and, you know, you just really see characters' faces in 70 millimeter. And then, of course, the sound is like a data sound. It's not magnetic like it used to be.
Right, right.
Because that was made illegal. And that's probably, you know, which used to be the big differentiator.
Wait, magnetic sound is illegal?
Yeah, there's like some toxic stuff in the magnetic strips. And so that was deemed as a...
Okay.
Yeah, so they can't do magnetic strip film anymore. If the print exists, then, you know, it's still showable if you happen to have a theater that can show magnetic.
Right. Okay.
There's only like maybe a couple of theaters, and that's what makes the Davis Square Cinema in Somerville so great. They spent, when they got the projectors, they spent like 5 years slowly collecting all of the various sound equipment so that all the different prints that had all the various Dolby, iterations over the years, they could play everything. They were just fanatical about collecting this
that's
stuff.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so if there's a magnetic strip six track, they can show it. And honestly, I've seen a lot of the six strip films the six track films at their festivals, and the sound of magnetic is way better than any other thing, maybe outside of IMAX.
Well, yeah, it's a rich analog medium without as much dynamic range compression as...
Well, that's the thing. You get the full dynamic range. So you will feel things a lot of times than necessarily hear them in a magnetic track. It's like you almost feel like air blowing in your face.
Yeah. Okay. So right off the bat, you're into this movie in a way that you weren't before.
I am in it. And of course, I'm sitting there with Bill from Queens, and, you know, we have the sort of same sense of humor, and he's loving it. He's laughing. And so him laughing is making me laugh, and then me laughing is making him laugh, and just really enjoying the experience a lot more, right? But probably about halfway through this thing, I'm thinking to myself, I'm reevaluating this entire movie.
Right.
And I found the scene that really just... It kind of was slow and boring for me the first go around was the Rick Dalton on the set of Lancer and that whole his whole character. I remember a lot of times thinking, I can't wait to go back to what Cliff Booth is doing or what Sharon Tate's doing. And this time was completely different. And maybe it was a 70 millimeter or a second, but I mean, I was so absorbed with everything that was happening and it was so entertaining. And then when it was cross-cut with Cliff Booth going to the Spahn Ranch, what I really was experiencing was like, wow, this is so great. Tarantino is giving you two different Westerns here.
Right, and he's cross-cutting them.
Yeah, one's a modern-day Western for the time of 69, and it's on the Spahn Ranch, which was, just a few years before that, an actual TV movie set for Westerns. And so now it's kind of a ghost town, and so you have this whole ghost town showdown thing with Cliff Booth and these Manson followers.
Yeah, and it almost has, like, shots out of High Noon. I mean, not literally.
It's got a very Western feel. And, you know, you had mentioned things like, you know, the horse back riding there. And, you know, it's like he's giving you all of these real Western-y things happening while across town, Rick Dalton is pretending.
Right.
In that classic TV style of Western. And then, of course, even the camera movements and everything.
Yes.
It's very theatrical because I don't think you'd even shoot a film or a TV show the way that they show it in this movie, where it's like one of these long takes and it goes from, you know, space to space.
Yeah, no, they wouldn't shoot it that way at all. And and Tarantino knows that. This is sort of an idealized version of what it would be like shooting a TV show, which allows it to focus entirely on the performances and not the mechanics of making the film. So I think that's just an intentional sort of little fantasy of how production actually works, film production works.
And also, to answer a question you had with Luke Perry in his character, I definitely think that his line reading was intentional.
Yeah, okay. I thought so too.
You know, there's sort of this mythology now. Now, anytime you mention Boston, you're going to have a thick Boston accent.
Right.
But back in the 60s and shows, you didn't have that. People,
right,
were, no matter where, you were just from someplace, but you wouldn't necessarily have any kind of regional tongue. And so I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, you know? I think it's interesting too. And the idea that that character has a little bit more depth than, it needed to.
Right. So I'm enjoying all this, and now we're getting closer and closer to the big climax. And a couple of times during the movie, I see Bill from Queens leaning over to his left. He was on the left side of me, so he's leaning over to the left, and he's leaning down, and he's clearly texting, right? Something. And you know me, that's like a big no-no.
Yeah, but you got five kids, you got to kind of excuse it a little bit, but yeah.
I guess. I don't know what he's texting. He could be texting anybody. Who knows?
Big no-no for me, but yeah.
Well, I'm always like, who is so important, right? Are you a doctor? Like, you know, like, who's getting these texts that you can't concentrate on a movie? I mean, you know, it wasn't free to get in there. It was $20, right? Because it's New York City and it's 70 millimeters. So it normally would have been $15, but they gave you a $5 surcharge for being 70 millimeter. And I'm still okay with that because now film prints are so expensive to ship.
Right.
And if that's what it takes to keep them, you know, popping those out.
Well, but it is a
I'll
premium.
It.
It's like, you know, 3D used to be a premium.
Exactly. So, you know, now it's like I see something in 3D and I'm like, oh God, I'm not going to that.
Me too. Me too. I think I might see Avatar 4 in 3D.
Yeah, that would be, that would make sense, you know? So he's done that a couple times and, you know, I have other friends will do that. It won't. You'll never see that happening to me, by the way.
No, I just will
not do that. I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm in a theater. What was it like in 1985? Did I have a smartphone? No, I had to watch the whole movie. Nobody could get me. If there was somebody dying, I'd find out afterwards.
You and I have a habit of texting each other right before the movie starts.
That's fine.
Which I think is hilarious. I text you, I'm sitting in the theater about to watch it. And then, you know, a few hours later, saw it.
Yeah, that's right. And that is okay.
Yeah.
I will give you that. And I'll tell you this little bit of the story at the end. But so we're getting closer and closer. Now we're in the big moment, right?
Right.
You've got the Manson family
coming up
Cielo Drive.
The driveway, yeah.
And, you know, it's just like, this is it, right? And this is the part where, sure, I've seen it, and I don't know how it's going to play for me a second time, but I'm sitting with somebody who doesn't know what's happening. So it's exciting for me to see what he's going to be at.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right. So all the all the shit's going down, right? And at this point, Bill from Queens is literally not paying any attention to the theater. He is like on his phone, frantically texting back and forth and stuff to a point where I'm like, it's distracting me.
Yeah, now you've got to say something. You've got to step in.
Because I'm like, he's missing details, and it's like, this is the big film we're waiting for. And I actually said, what are you doing? And he like was like, Jimmy, I got something. Like, I'm like, no, you don't have something going on. You have the movie going on. This is what you're here to watch the movie. And thank God we're in the back and no one's watching this, because then they'd be yelling at you and I would have to join them in yelling at you. Right? So, and this goes on, honest to God, through almost the whole thing.
Oh.
And even to like the credits now are happening, and he's like, oh, Jimmy, I'm going to have to leave as soon as this is over. I'm like, yeah, I guessed that you would. So here's the thing. It turns out that, and I don't even know, I don't have all the details, but one of his kids, two of his kids, I don't know which kid it was, he said something about there was some emergency, like, track, he called it a track fire in Jamaica, which is Queens, as he's from Queens, but his kids were out in Jamaica, which is pretty far out in Queens, and there was some kind of track fire. That's what he had, a track. I'm like, I mean, like high school track? What kind of track fire are you talking
like
about?
Train track.
Right, right. Well, I figured it was, but I didn't get those details. So we get out of the movie. Right. And there was somebody that met up with me for dinner, and she was waiting. And of course, you know, he's like itching to go because he's got to go somewhere. And I'm like, you remember her and blah, 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 my old roommate, Bill. And but he's got to go. He's got an emergency track fire. So he goes. Right. And then I think the next day he says, my kid survived the great track fire of Jamaica 2019, right? So now I'm like, okay, I don't want to bust his balls, but I got to find this out. So I look up. I'm like, I got to find out, what was this track fire? So I look up online, and sure enough, there was a fire. There was a fire in Jamaica, Jamaica, Queens,
right.
And it was at a like a junkyard.
Okay.
And it may have been near the train tracks, okay? So it could have caused some delays or something, but here's the funny thing is he took the train in to see me. So I don't know what he was supposed to do as the rescue. He was going to have to drive back to Queens on the train, and then I don't know how he's going to get them. I don't know what the deal was, but here's this is the kicker, right? So there was this fire at the junkyard in Queens, but it had happened the day before. It wasn't even on the same day. So I don't even know what he was talking about. Maybe this is what I'm thinking, is that the only way that his story makes sense is if for some reason, because of the fire the day before, trains weren't running quite right. If, you know, but again, I don't know. He had his reasons.
Yeah. And apparently it needed a lot of text. Well, we should have him come on the show just to talk about the end of the movie.
Yeah, right, because he'll have to go see it a second time, because he won't know what exactly happened. He sort of did. It just did. So, you know what? Unfortunately, I'm not going to blame Bill for that he didn't ruin the experience for me, but
right.
I didn't, out of the second time going, I didn't enjoy the conclusion of the movie as much as I did the first time, and I don't know whether it's because when you know what's going to happen, it's not as impactful, or is it because I had somebody texting through the entire climax of the movie?
I think the texting probably had a lot to do with it. That those little distractions can kind of throw your mood off.
Yeah, so kids, don't text and drive, and don't text and go to his movie.
But that said, there's, you know, I think the ending is worth debating. I think there's, you know, another friend of mine said that he thought the ending was childish. You know, I can actually see that. When a piece of art takes a big leap, which is what that is, essentially, it takes this big leap at the end, and it's either going to be brilliant or a complete failure. There's really no middle ground there. For some people, it is a failure, that it puts this fairy tale revenge ending on a tragedy.
I have a little bit of mixed feelings on this, that I like it, but I also think, you know, if he could have challenged himself further, of course, it would have completely different movie.
Right.
I think that it would have been interesting if he could have gone a different route. I don't know. However, now that the whole film, I've seen it now twice, I am ready in my reevaluation, and part of that, because I had some time, like in the past week,
right?
Because I had family that was away, and I had nothing better to do with my time than to look down at some of Tarantino's other work. I rewatched a few other of his films just to get my thoughts. And now in my rankings of the, well, we'll say nine films. He likes to say nine films. I'll say the nine films of Tarantino.
Right.
I am comfortably putting Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as his number two.
And Pulp Fiction first?
Pulp Fiction first for me.
Okay.
But it is, to me, it's really strong. Like the movie he makes now, he couldn't have made if he didn't make the other films before it.
Right.
So even the film that a lot of people don't like, but I do, The Hateful Eight, I think that in many ways helped him in making this film.
So do you, what is it that sets this film apart? Because I think it does, it is apart from the rest of his work in some important ways, I think.
You know, I listened to an entire podcast of him talking about how he built that soundtrack.
Right.
And hearing his process for building the soundtrack for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's exactly what I think and feel all filmmakers should be doing. You know, he wanted, it wasn't enough to pick songs he liked,
No. You're telling a story through the music.
Yeah. However, he was telling a story through the particular radio station that was popular in LA at the time.
Okay.
And so what he got his research team together is they pulled 17 hours that they were able to get of audio.
Oh, wow.
From 68 and 69 from that radio station. And as he pointed out, this wasn't some archived material that the radio station had.
Right, right.
This was somebody who was a private collector who back then like taped those programs.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And so afterwards, he culled it down to 3 hours of material, like
right.
intros, outros, and songs that were surrounding them that he felt were really what he wanted. And that's what he worked in. And then usually a lot of times those versions that were in, to get clearance, some of those versions were special radio versions of the songs that you don't typically hear. And it was, I mean, it's a crazy process.
Right.
But see, that gives there a real authenticity to make you feel in those small, subtle ways that you are back in a place that you certainly never visited,
because
I wasn't born in the 60s, but it feels so real. And when you can make an audience feel that this is real and authentic, that allows you to start playing with the narrative in ways
exactly.
that aren't necessarily real. And that's what is, you know, that's a great, it's brilliant direction.
Yeah, it absolutely is. But unfortunately, you're wrong about a lot of this.
Who is?
You are.
Oh, I am?
Yes.
What? Why am I wrong?
Well, according to you, Hooks 31, who is a big fan of many Tarantino flicks.
Oh, well, that's important to know. So this guy, he's a big fan.
Well, as he says, Pulp Fiction is one of my all-time favorites.
Gotcha.
But this, waste of cash.
Oh, it's a waste of cash.
No story, no plot, and hardly any dialogue for Sharon Tate.
Well, he isn't wrong. There isn't a lot of dialogue for Sharon Tate.
Yeah, and that apparently is a big problem with this movie, is that it's not the movie that you, Hooks 31, wanted it to be.
Right, or thought. That's the problem. It's not even about wanting. It's like, oh, well, he's doing something with Sharon Tate, so it's going to be all about her, right?
Exactly, or it's going to be all about the Manson family. And so, going through negative reviews of this movie, a lot of it is people who it just wasn't what they expected or thought it was going to be. And that's what they're disappointed in. The big slam against this movie is that it's boring because nothing happens. As Tigerfish50 says, Once Upon a Time continues Tarantino's decline as a writer and director.
Although this guy like Michael J. Fox movies?
Although the principal weakness of his latest film is a rambling screenplay which develops neither story nor characters.
That's all he's got to say?
Oh, it goes on.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. The movie looks decent enough, but oodles of time is wasted venerating the trashy TV shows and films of that period.
Hmm.
There are interminable episodes where Rick delivers some routine overacting as a villainous cowboy in a formulaic TV plot, intercut with Sharon Tate visiting a cinema to watch a spoof spy movie, blah, blah, blah. More than 100 minutes are spent on a procession of similarly inconsequential set pieces, which do little more than provide background. Eventually, the ghostly apparition of an actual story emerges.
The ghostly apparition.
So, but yeah, okay, I got a couple more for you. This is from Kim DeWinter 31. A diluted hodgepodge of historical inaccuracies and montages of good old Hollywood. So some of these reviews are actually slamming the fact that the art direction is so good, as though it's sort of overplaying its hand on its historical accuracy.
See, if you want to take down a piece, what people should really study is the great contrarian reviewer, Armand White.
Absolutely.
I found, I don't have it with me, I'm sorry, but I found his review of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And he thinks it's Tarantino's best work.
Right.
However, that doesn't mean he liked it. He trashes the crap out of the movie, yet he finds himself. See, this, he's a real puzzler, this guy.
Yeah,
he's like,
is.
I wonder, does he like movies? Because sometimes it seems like he likes movies, but he knows his job is to not like it. So he very, very well articulates why the movie is garbage. And he definitely models himself out of the, you know, the great reviewer there. What's her name?
Pauline Kael.
Yeah, he models himself after Pauline Kael to be that contrarian viewpoint. And his reviews are notoriously amusing.
Oh, yeah, they're great to read, yeah.
And I only wish that IMDb people, if they're going to, like, you know, find ways to trash a movie, they got to learn how to trash a movie properly.
Well, they do, and I think, you know, the criticisms of this movie are pretty easy, and everyone's making essentially the same ones, which is that it doesn't have enough of a plot, and it's boring, and it wasn't what I thought a movie about the Manson family should be about.
Yeah, I got to tell you, watching it a second time, man, I was not bored even for an instant.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, and I think it's a film that people will reevaluate as they see it more and more. And it is, you know, it's kind of like Jackie Brown in that way, though this is a much better movie than Jackie Brown, but that you can enjoy it upon, you know, further viewings. Because, again, as I mentioned, when Jackie Brown came out, there was the expectation for what his next movie after Pulp Fiction was yes, almost too high. You couldn't, and I still feel like if all he did was try to catch the magic that he got in Pulp Fiction, he's going to fail because it's a one-off film. All the things came together for that film and things hadn't been done, or even though that much of that movie are repurposed from other films, he did it in a way that most audiences just hadn't seen before. And if you're going to steal from foreign films that people haven't seen. I mean, I watched a year ago on Criterion Lady Snowblood, and I was like, my jaw dropped at just how much of that movie he ripped off for Kill Bill. And it wasn't, he knows, he even took music from that film.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was just, and so it's kind of cool to see a movie like Lady Snowblood and realize, hey, he can repurpose from all these films that no one's seen, and you're going to feel like it's brand new.
Have you seen, I think it's City on Fire?
I haven't. What is that?
Oh, that's the movie that Reservoir Dogs completely rips off.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Who directed that?
I don't know. I think it's a Korean film.
Oh, okay. I'm going to have to take a look for that and see if I can find it.
Yeah, and it's basically Reservoir Dogs is a complete, almost remake of this movie.
Well, almost like Star Wars is almost a complete remake of Hidden Fortress.
Right, yeah.
And I did watch Reservoir Dogs again as part of this sort of...
Your Tarantino?
Yeah. I hadn't seen Reservoir Dogs in a good 15 years. And there were some great parts in it. There were some parts also that I feel like it's a first-time movie.
Yeah, but it's a good, it's a really solid first-time movie. It shows, you know, who he is and what he's going to do. And I don't know, I like Reservoir Dogs, but you were making the point last time we talked about it that the stuff in the in the room works, the bottle movie part of it, but the stuff outside of it doesn't work as well.
Well, I think it's just, I look at, if you take those, a few of those scenes out that aren't really even necessary, then you have like an hour and 10 minute movie.
Right.
And that's the thing. But it does help. It dealt, you know, he was able to get a first film off. And again, the stuff that was so great and fresh that people hadn't quite experienced was characters talking a certain way.
Exactly.
And, you know, a great example is right after the credits roll at the beginning and you jump into the action and you suddenly, you know, you don't even know what kind of, that they were on a job.
Right.
But then suddenly you have Harvey Keitel racing to the rendezvous point and you've got Tim Roth like covered in blood.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way because you don't know exactly what's happened, but you realize things didn't go well.
Right.
didn't go to plan.
And it plants a question in the audience's mind that you want answered and...
Yeah. And Tim Roth is like, I mean, in a way that's, it's like, it's gorier because he is in such pain that you feel it through his performance. But then Harvey Keitel does this great thing. And it's stuff that, again, I had not seen in a movie before. He's reaching back, trying to comfort him. And he's like, excuse me. I don't think you have a medical license. Like, you know, he's trying to calm him down. And it's just, it's like, it's lines like that delivered in a way that that's just sort of the staples of things he does.
Yes.
And if it was so easy, you know, everybody's picking on Tarantino, but if this was so easy to do all these things, like have the music a certain way, have the sets, then everybody would be doing it, but nobody can do it.
But
and so it can't be that easy.
Very few people are doing it. And the good news is the movie is making money.
It is. I mean, the bad news is supposedly because of marketing and all the back end deals for the actors, you know, that...
Yeah.
Some sources say that the movie cost $100 million, which is a lot for what, you know, that type of film, and it all goes into, you know, salaries and all the set design and stuff, that the movie would have to gross worldwide $400 million for Sony to get a profit.
Well, it's close to $200.
Yeah, and then, you know, worldwide, but we'll see.
But the thing is, movies, particularly a movie like this, is going to make a lot of money over time.
Yeah, I think that they'll be fine. And you know what? Here's the thing, right? So Tarantino and his retirement thing, he may be coming out of retirement because he's going to have a baby.
Oh, man.
That just got announced. And, you know, when you have a baby, things change. For a few years, he might be tied up. And then it's going to change how he is as a filmmaker because that always happens.
And he's going to start making kids' movies.
Well, no, he's not going to necessarily do that. But here's what's going to happen is he's going to realize something that, oh, wait, money. I need to now have a future for my child. And suddenly I need to work and secure that future. And I didn't realize that, you know, the money I was making was fine for me, but now I'm married and have a child. So I think that could change the direction of his later career.
I'm going to bet against you on this one, but we shall see.
Only time will tell. But, you know, it's interesting is I think on the I'm with him on retirement.
Yeah.
Just every movie he makes, there's some controversy that comes out, right? That's just the way it is with Tarantino.
Yeah, and that's part of the marketing plan almost.
It is, and he has to expect it because no matter what, people will find something to controversial. But I think that this Bruce Lee controversy that's happened, that could be what sends him and says, you know what? I don't need this anymore.
Yeah,
this
I agree.
Fine.
Yeah, just, you know, enough of that.
Because this guy loves Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
He's always loved Bruce Lee, and I don't think he thought, you know, again, I don't think sometimes the controversy, you don't know where it's going to creep up. I mean, I think he probably expected there'd be a lot of controversy on Sharon Tate and the Manson thing.
Right, but there's no controversy on that. It's all on this Bruce Lee thing.
Yeah, well, the controversy is that Sharon doesn't get to say as much as people thought she should be saying, but the Bruce Lee thing still flummoxes me.
Yeah, me too. I don't totally get it.
Well, and it's it, but here, but I try to break this down, right? And I, you know, I know that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was a student of Bruce Lee's, he was asked to weigh in. And of course, what is the guy supposed to do, right? So he's like,
I read his article about it. Actually.
Yeah, he's like, I love Tarantino films. I'm thinking to myself, well, you do? You never had a problem with every one of his movies saying the N-word 50,000 times? But this film, you know, and I guess it's really, you know, maybe it speaks to just how Hollywood has treated the Asian community over the years and the lack of Asian heroes.
Yes.
And so.
Well, and because of that, Bruce Lee is really venerated, and rightfully so.
Yeah, it's like, well, they don't, it's like, you know, we don't want all our heroes to be torn down. But it's an interesting thing because, see, this is what this movie at its core gets to. It's about mythologies being broken. So at some point does Tarantino say, you know what, it's not worth the hassle, man. I made my movies and I try to do this thing and people don't like it. But you know what I mean? I think he gets tired after a while. And
if he's even listening to people.
Well, it may be, but like, I mean, I just think of these films that talk about the bias. People are so afraid. And I'm talking to people in the entertainment community, the critics, etc.
Right.
They don't want to upset the big lion, Disney, that they won't say a bad, bad word or write any kind of follow-up think piece on how shitty these movies are. And I'm like, because it's just crazy. That Lion King was not a good movie. In my opinion, it really was not.
I did not see it. I did see the best movie of the summer, though.
What was the best movie of the summer?
Okay, no, not the best movie of the summer. The best summer movie.
Ah, okay. Difference.
Yes. I think there's a big difference there. And the best summer movie, in my opinion, is Hobbs and Shaw.
And I can't remember. We may have had to do some editing. It was a very long episode last week or 2 weeks ago. But I saw Hobbs and Shaw as well, and I feel it is the quintessential Doritos movie for 2019.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I think, as an action flick, it's great. It has action. And what I like about these Hobbs and Shaw characters is they are not just gun guys. There's a lot of punching. And I think that's awesome. And this movie does something towards the end where it actually, all the bad guys have these electronic ID guns. And so our heroes manage to turn off their guns. And so for a whole section of the movie, there's no guns. There's just people punching each other. And that was pretty great. And not to mention, as people punching each other, is a bunch of, where are they? They're...
In England, everywhere. There's,
well, yeah, no, they're all over the place in this movie. But,
oh, you mean in the last part where they go to the Rock's home?
Yeah, are they in Samoa?
Yes.
Yeah, and so there's all these Samoan guys, like, using traditional Samoan weapons and beating up all these mercenaries. And it's awesome.
I can't have any complaint. It didn't try to be anything other than what it set out to be. Pure entertainment.
Pure entertainment. Pure PG-13 entertainment, I should add. It's not very gory. It's not very bloody. I went with my 11-year-old, and she loved it. And the other thing is, I know there's a lot of special effects and a lot of CGI in these movies, but this one actually had some real cars at times.
Yes. I don't know how well enhanced they are with CGI, but yeah, they did.
There's definitely stuff that's CGI enhanced, but there's also stuff that was actual stunts.
For me, anyway, I found this way more enjoyable than the standard Fast and Furious movies.
Oh, I don't really like the standard Fast and Furious movies because they're too car-oriented.
Yeah, like, see, they take themselves too seriously, and then they're just ridiculous, and I don't like that mix, whereas this film, it set itself up as like a crazy, goofy spy franchise. They've even put in like a James Bondian, like Blofeld supervillain. I mean, there was lots of comedy, and you got the Ryan Reynolds there making some jokes.
Yep, he made some jokes. The movie had a really good attitude to it. It was a fun,
totally good,
a fun, optimistic punch 'em up.
Yeah, I mean, of course, if you want to talk controversy, this has already been, you know, mentioned, but it's kind of funny that Vanessa Kirby was playing the younger sibling of Shaw, but yet in real life, she's like 25 years younger than he is.
Right.
And they were only supposed to be like 2 or 3 years difference in the movie. It's movies. You can make it up.
In a movie like this, it's so silly. It's so over the top. I can't get into splitting those kinds of hairs with it because I just don't care when it comes down to it. What I care about is watching The Rock punch people and and Jason Statham try to look like he's a competent movie star.
But you know, they work really well together.
They
in
work
this movie.
Really well together.
Good chemistry.
My daughter definitely liked Dwayne Johnson better. She just thought he was awesome, and I understand why kids like him. He's like this big goofy teddy bear guy.
Oh, my whole family likes him. I mean, he is a bona fide movie star.
Yes.
Because everybody, if when everybody in the family will go because of the guy being in the movie or the girl being in the movie, that's a movie star.
Exactly. Yeah. And there aren't as many, there's fewer and fewer of them, actually.
Yeah, like Jason Statham, he's an action star.
Right.
But Dwayne The Rock Johnson is a movie star.
Is a movie star, total movie star. And yeah, there aren't that many people left who can open a movie, really.
Well, Dwayne Johnson is probably the closest approximation to the way Arnold Schwarzenegger became
yes.
in the late 80s, where
yes.
once he crossed over and did, say, Twins, and people could laugh with him too, he
right.
suddenly crossed over to all facets of your family. Kids could like him and adults.
I watched another movie the other day that I was thinking this about, and the movie that, was it The Farewell you were talking about?
Yes. You saw that?
No, I didn't see it, but you were talking about how it's a movie for people like from 8 to 80.
Our last show, I spoke about The Farewell, but due to time, we edited it out, and it's a fantastic film that you should try to go see, and I felt that it's something that anyone, you know, who can read subtitles should
right.
enjoy the film. From 8 to 80, you could love this movie.
Yeah, so I just a few days ago watched Searching for Bobby Fischer with my kids.
Oh, yeah, that's a great film.
It's a great film. I hadn't seen it in a number of years. Thanks to the great cinematography by the great Conrad Hall, this movie, which came out in 1993, does not look the least bit dated. You know, they don't have cell phones and the internet, but the cinematography is beautiful still. This movie holds up visually really well. And my kids loved this movie, and I realized that there's very few movies in this category where it's about a kid, but it's not a kid's movie. Kids can watch it, but it's essentially a drama that is within reality. It's a drama. It's not really a comedy at all. And
well, no, it's not a comedy at all.
There aren't a lot of these family dramas that can be watched basically by everyone.
Well, I think that is a difference. When we grew up, you know, we talk about it all the time. Your parents would sometimes prefer you saw radar movies as a kid
yes.
because it was more, you know,
more substantive.
Fare. But
yeah,
there was a lot of films, you know, before, and I think of the time before PG-13 came out. PG-13 did a lot of damage, and mostly
it
because
really did. Yeah.
It found that audiences, that was a sweet spot where kids loved to go see a movie that they felt was a little bit more edgy
right.
and not rated R, but a lot of dramas disappeared. There were a lot of films that you could watch before 1984 that were rated PG, and
right.
I would want to see them as a kid, like a movie like Kramer versus Kramer.
Yes, absolutely. Or even Gandhi or something like that.
Yeah, these are movies that today would absolutely be rated PG-13. And quite honestly, sometimes you see a PG movie and you're like, why was this not rated R?
Right. Yeah. No. 80s PG is a whole different thing.
But did the audience, I mean, film going tastes have changed. People.
Yes.
And a lot of that's TV. I mean, the good dramas are now like these streaming mini 10 episode shows.
Right.
And so people don't want to go and pay and see that type of thing in the theater. But, you know, people used to. I mean, you had these great directors that, you know, like the Sidney Lumets.
Yes.
They had a brand of film that you would go see, or the Alan J. Pakula.
Yeah, the drama, basically, as a genre. And, I mean, they still do exist. I'm thinking like Manchester by the Sea or something, you know.
Yeah, but now you only will get those when it's like the fall or the late
exactly.
fall for Oscar time.
Well, and also I wouldn't necessarily take my kids to see Manchester by the Sea. I think they'd be...
That one, no.
Yeah,
no.
I think they'd be bored out of their minds by that.
Yeah, that's a tough subject matter. I mean, it's
yeah.
Whether I let my son, my oldest, watch a film isn't necessarily about too much violence or bad
right,
words
right.
or it's about whether or not would he understand the themes and really enjoy it, or would he walk away like not liking the film because he was too young to see it.
Exactly. Yeah, and you don't want to give somebody a bad first impression.
Yeah, so I mean, we've done a few experiments, and some of them pay off and some of them don't. And those experiments lead me to decide, yeah, we're not going to watch this one with him.
Right.
We'll watch this with him.
Yeah, wait a few more years on that other one. Yeah.
So Hobbs and Shaw, I think that was probably my favorite summer movie as far as for families. And then my probably perfect summer movie for me anyway was John Wick 3.
Right.
That's my more adult perfect summer movie. And then, of course, the two movies that I thought were the best films that I saw this summer, and maybe so far the best, the best three films I've seen this year are The Farewell and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Midsommar.
Yeah. Yeah, those are definitely, I haven't seen The Farewell yet, but.
Yeah. And like I said, I think the biggest surprise for me was Midsommar, because I really thought that was going to be terrible, and instead it was just great. And I like that there's so many people on the internet now are like, you know, they just talk about this film, and there's lots of memes, and people do drawings, and people are doing costumes, and it's just a film that's when a movie like enters a new realm, when people become obsessed with it.
I have a friend who hated it because he thought it was too funny.
I was in a theater where no one was laughing, though I chuckled a few times.
Yeah.
But I think that the humor, when you get an audience that's laughing a lot, if you could analyze that laughter, it's uncomfortable laughter.
Yeah.
They're laughing because it's so intense that it helps break up what's going on inside of them.
Yeah, and I think he was saying that basically some of the horror elements came across as silly. They were like too gory in a way that I don't know. I can.
Oh, they've seen that kind of head splitting in real life and said, "Nah, this is ridiculous. It's way over the top. Give me the Craig Zahler because he knows how to drag a head across some concrete." And if you really want bone crushing skills, not unless you see Vince Vaughn crush a guy's skull and stomp on it. That's when I'm not laughing.
Yeah, I mean, there's head.
I think that person was probably too freaked out and just couldn't handle it, and so they found it funny and didn't want to admit that this disturbed them. I think it really affects people differently.
I think that's true. I will still object to that one scene in Midsommar that I feel like actually the horror movie element of it is silly.
We did talk about that. We won't again, in case for some reason you didn't hear this the episode because you haven't seen it yet.
We won't go into more detail now. But speaking of, while we're on this horror subject for a second, a warning, don't see Brightburn.
I'm good. You don't even need to warn me. Yep. I had no desire to see Brightburn, and I didn't really know much about it. I know it's like a horror.
Well, I'll tell you the concept.
Comic book thing.
I'll tell you the concept because it's a great. I thought it was a great concept. It's basically the Superman origin story, where a couple finds a crash landed kid in their backyard from a meteor, or spaceship or whatever. So they find like the Superman baby, right?
I'm with you.
But then the Superman baby grows up to be evil.
Oh, okay.
So that's the concept. And so by the time the kid's like 11, he's starting to turn evil. But this could have been a really interesting kind of, to me anyway, interesting character piece and about like a child growing up and separating from the parents and all this sort of stuff. But instead, it's just a cheap slasher movie. It's like every 15 minutes they have to show the kid killing someone.
Oh, so it's Superman meets The Omen meets Problem Child.
Yes, with a completely incoherent script. This is a movie I thought it had a good concept. The direction and the acting, everything was fine, you know, good enough. And it was completely undone by a terrible screenplay that didn't add up and made no sense and didn't explore any of the things that were inherently interesting about it. So,
well, you just saved me some time, sir.
I just saved you some time. Do not watch Brightburn. It is
all right. On the same warning, don't see Shazam.
Okay.
It really was. I mean, my kids liked it because they thought it was funny, but I say this every time, but this could be the movie that sets me over the edge for not going to see any more superhero films ever again. It's it really feels like the kind of film that they were putting out for superhero movies in the 80s that kind of gave superheroes a bad name, and people were like, I'm not making a comic book movie. Forget it.
Well, is Shazam like a real movie, or is it just like a kid's movie? Is it just like for 5-year-olds, or...
I don't know. I mean, you would think that most of those superhero movies are for 5 years old, but that's not who's going to these things. It was just bad. I mean, I'm starting to, now I've seen enough of these films, probably more comic book movies than I ever thought, you know, grow most of my life that I was ever going to have to see. And they all of them, no matter whether it's this DC universe or this Marvel universe, they all seem to hinge on Seven Rings, Seven Kingdoms, Seven Deadly Sins, which is the case of Shazam, or Seven Realms, or...
Seven Dwarfs, Seven, man, that's the number. Seven chipmunks twirling on a branch, eating lots of sunflowers on my uncle's ranch. You know that old children's tale from the sea? It's like you're dreaming about Gorgonzola cheese when it's clearly... Free time, baby.
Seven Seas is an Aquaman, which coincidentally later that day I tried to watch on HBO because I skipped that in the theater. That looked terrible.
I would have warned you.
I got through 20 minutes. I don't think I can get through anymore. It's so bad.
That's about what I did, about 20 minutes. And it was just, unbelievable. Even like the action scenes are bad.
Well, the beginning of the movie, right, where like this lighthouse keeper, and then he meets, you know, Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
I couldn't get over the fact that they did some kind of weird CGI de-aging on their faces or something. They just didn't look like real people.
Right.
It really bothered me. And Nicole Kidman, you know, I get it. Anybody that gets offered these movies at this point, they're like, they make billions of dollars. I get a great paycheck, residuals. This is an important part of my retirement plan. But Nicole Kidman really looks like an actor who doesn't want to be there. Like, I feel like this would be as if they got Meryl Streep in on one of these movies. She'd show up and she's like, I better not act too good because I don't want any Oscar nominations for being in a superhero movie. And I just don't think Nicole Kidman's heart is in this. She's like, I freaking want an Oscar, man, for playing Virginia Woolf. And now I'm playing some kind of water goddess. This is not right. It's really, you know, it's bad. And so I just, but the Shazam, it was so bad. The special effects were terrible. And
it looked like a cheesy 80s movie from the trailer. I did see the trailer for that.
Oh, it is really, there was a few laughs. Like I said, there was some laughs in the middle. I have to admit that I was laughing, but it's terrible. And then there's this thing that's on like Amazon Prime called The Boys, which is this revisionist superhero thing. I know that we have a listener that mentioned how bad it was. I got through one episode and it feels like an R-rated CW show.
Okay. Right?
They're always cranking out superhero shows. It feels that bad with actors that you don't know.
I think it's time to put the whole hero mythology to rest for a little while.
Well, I wonder if there will be fatigue and will this Disney Plus channel, is that going to kill it? Like, are people going to be like, you know, enough is enough already?
No more Marvel for us. And we're so pissed off about the Spider-Man thing that we're going to ban Marvel.
Which is funny, right? Because this is another thing, right? There's a million think pieces on why the Bruce Lee scene is terrible in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But nobody's writing the truth that Spider-Man movie was the worst bag of shit that I've ever seen on the screen. It is so bad. It is terrible. And it was a horrible villain. And it was a villain. Look, I'm going to just, you saw it, right? Or you didn't see it.
No, but, like, I didn't see it. And I don't care.
There's your buddy there, Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
Right? He plays this guy Mysterio. It is obvious from the very first seconds that everything this guy's doing is a con job and that they're not fighting these real villains.
Right.
They don't look real. They look like faker than regular CGI. So how could anybody figure out that these were real? And of course they're not. They're like some kind of hologram thing that Mysterio's created because he wants to be like a superhero. And of course, somebody that used to work for Tony Stark. And it's like, we did this the last Spider-Man movie, right?
Yes.
And much better. And so when that's so obvious to me, why is it not? I mean, this is crap. I'm like, this is what you're giving me? And then there's this whole confusing thing about who like disappeared during the Thanos snap and who didn't. And I couldn't quite tell you which character had been away for 5 years and not, and who would age and who's not. I guess every single person that was important to the movie didn't age and they were away because otherwise it would make no sense. It was so convoluted, this movie.
Okay.
I didn't like 1 ounce of that film, and I don't care. Maybe, you know, someone's going to be like, you know, listens to the show and starts to tear me a new one. Come at me, bro.
Okay. You heard it here first. Yeah.
I'm the person that says I could care less. Sony and Marvel don't make another Spider-Man movie together. Big effing deal. I could care less because it was a hard, like that movie was a hard, I can't believe it made $1 billion.
Yeah, that, well, that's why we keep getting them for now.
I know that's the problem. I keep waiting for the dam to break, but they don't. You could make the worst movie imaginable. Unless you're of course, DC Comics, because Shazam
right.
was terrible and people saw it and said it's terrible and it didn't make that much money.
Yeah, DC just can't seem to get it together. We'll see with this Joker movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? If it wasn't for the possibility of seeing it in 70mm, I would definitely skip it. I didn't see the Venom movie. I had no desire for that.
Oh, the Venom movie is really... I think your youngest would like it.
Yeah, I know. Ugh. All right. See, now I'm in a... I was in a good mood, man. I was in a real good mood. Good,
it's just... Look, August is kind of rough.
It is.
For the film game. And we got the fall coming up, so there's a lot to look forward to.
Yeah, and you know what? On our next episode, we probably won't be talking about any new movies we've seen, but I'm sure we will get into... You know, some catch up on stuff, and we'll craft together something fun for you, the listener.
Yeah, because there's not a lot playing at the theater that I'm running out to see this week, except maybe Dora and the Lost City of Gold.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I didn't hear what you just said because I was busy texting because my kids are experiencing a flood up the street. Oh, no, I'm just joking. You know, like I said, peace and love, Bill from Queens.
Yes.
We love you. I just don't know if I'd go to the movies with you again unless all of your family was there and nobody had a cell phone in their hands. Oh, which, man. By the way, that so this is the ending of the story I forgot, is that my wife, she was in Texas, and on her last night there with the family, her and her mom got to go to the Alamo Draft House.
Oh.
And see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in 35mm. They do like pre-show entertainment. They have the place decked out really cool. They serve awesome food. And before that, and then like the waiter, they take great care to make sure that all the food's delivered before the movie starts. They show like funny old like coming attraction trailer things. They gave these fun little cards for like a movie game, and it has like cute little cartoons on it, like a reel of film and all these other things.
How much does this all cost?
I don't know, but it was, you know, she said it was fantastic. It was such a great movie experience. And they even played Tarantino's favorite coming attractions trailer at the beginning where it says, you know, the da 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 da.
Oh, I don't know what that is.
You know it. I'll insert it in the episode, and then you'll be like, oh, that. Yeah, he plays it at the beginning of, like, he played at the beginning of Grindhouse.
Oh, yes, okay.
And, like, and also, like, the Kill Bill movies, and yes. He even uses it in the drive-in in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
That's right.
She just said it was the greatest. And of course, they don't let you text in that movie. And if you're caught texting, they throw you right out.
Yep. Bill would
so
be
Bill
out
from
on
Queens
street.
Would not be able to go to the Alamo Draft House. He would be put in the basement with Pee-wee's bike.
Okay.
All right. Well, hey. It's been fun catching up with you, sir.
Yeah, this has been a catch-up episode.
Yep. And, you know, again, it'll be more Tarantino than we thought we would be talking about.
Somehow that always happens.
Yep. All right. Well, as always, catch us on stuffweveseen.com and on the web also on Instagram or Twitter. And you can send us an email at feedback@jimandteal.com. And please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Tune in. I don't know. You know, tune in. Is that something you subscribe to and then you get all the episodes, or how does that work?
No, I don't know. It just, yes, you can subscribe to it and get all the episodes. Exactly. It's just like all the other services.
If you're one of those Alexa people, like you,
yes,
right?
Yes, if you're listening on your voice-activated listening device robot thing, tune in is a good way to get the show.
All right, well, there you go. And I will talk to you later and see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Or, no, I say see you next time. What is the goodbye? Is that...
Talk to you next time?
Talk to you next time.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye.